Shrink Wrap Radio Number 40, June 25th, 2006. Practical Police Psychology. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
What's phenomenal is that as a whole, negotiated hostage situations have a 95% success rate. That is, it's resolved without any violence taking place. And it's hard to imagine most medical procedures in critical situations that have a 95% success rate. It's a tribute to the power of human communication to defuse situations. Hostage situations are unique because they combine elements of danger with the presence of a usually disturbed or distraught hostage taker, and you have the presence of innocent people whose lives are at stake at every second. But again, the same generalizable skills of crisis intervention that you would use for a suicide intervention or any other kind of violent subject or a barricade situation where someone doesn't want to come out but there may not be actual hostages, the same types of verbal approaches are effective in these situations. You're just applying it to one particular area.
The voice you just heard is that of Lawrence Miller, Ph.D., who is the author of a fascinating book titled Practical Police Psychology, Stress Management and Crisis Intervention for Law Enforcement. Dr. Miller is the police psychologist for the West Palm Beach Police Department, a forensic psychological examiner for the Palm Beach County Court, and a consulting psychologist with several regional and national law enforcement agencies. Dr. Miller is also an instructor at the Police Academy, Criminal Justice Institute of Palm Beach County, and he's on the adjunct psychology faculty at Florida Atlantic University. His specialties include clinical psychology, neuropsychology, forensic psychology, and business psychology, and his list of professional affiliations, publications, and speaking engagements is too long to list here. So let's get right into the interview. My guest today is forensic psychologist Dr. Lawrence Miller. Larry, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
I'm glad to be here.
Great. There's so much about your career that we could discuss, but I think I'd like to focus on your latest book, Practical Police Psychology, which just came out this year. Who's your intended audience for this book?
I actually wrote this as kind of a crossover book because as a psychologist, I live in the world of psychology, but as a police psychologist, I live in the world of police officers and police administrators. And one of the reasons for writing the book is I don't think that either camp really knows about or sufficiently appreciates what the others can contribute to the field.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, most police officers run into psychologists either in the course of some kind of disciplinary action, such as being evaluated for a fitness for duty evaluation or something like that, or they're referred by their EAP for some kind of mandatory counseling. And they really don't have an idea of how psychology can contribute to better policing in general. What's interesting is that one area where psychology supposedly is appreciated is in the area of forensic examination, such as behavioral profiling. And there, psychological concepts are utilized routinely. But in the day-to-day work of police officers who basically patrol the streets and ride in cars and protect citizens, the contribution of psychology is under-recognized.
Okay.
The book was kind of for them as well.
Mm-hmm. So what was your goal in writing the book? What do you hope it will accomplish?
Well, I wanted to take psychology and write a book that was, you know, rigorous in terms of the science and the methodology and the content behind it, but again, emphasize the term practical. Because what I try to do in each chapter is give principles that a police officer can use on a day-to-day basis in their practical work on patrol or in special kinds of assignments such as undercover, hostage negotiation, and so on. And also I wanted a text that psychologists could use who either work with law enforcement officers or may be planning to or considering it that would give them some guidance into the world of law enforcement and how they can best apply their skills in a practical, focused way.
Well, I tell you, I think that you really succeeded in your goals. I have to tell you, I've spent several hours with the copy of the book that you recently sent me, and I'm very, very impressed. I think the book potentially has a much wider appeal than the audience that you've specified. As you point out, due to the influence of Hollywood and a variety of novels and so on, the police have achieved a kind of mythic stature in the popular imagination, for both good and for bad. So in that sense, I think we're all interested in the police. And I even think that your book, Practical Police Psychology, would make a great coffee table book, even though it doesn't have any pictures, or a good bathroom book that people could pick up and read random short selections. Because I found it...
I'm not sure I like the direction this is going, but I do appreciate the comments, and I am someone who can take a compliment graciously, so I do appreciate your confidence in the book.
Really, the bathroom recommendation is meant in the best possible way.
We'll try to get it onto coffee tables and bathrooms all across America.
Yeah, because I found it easy to jump in anywhere into the book and to find something that was both interesting and practical. I find that your book is chock full of really practical advice. It's titled Practical Police Psychology, and I think you really achieved that goal of providing a manual of practical approaches to dealing with stress management and crisis intervention issues that at some point are likely to pop up in nearly everyone's lives. And if I can rave on...
Yeah, I mean, I think the principles in the book are somewhat universal because
yeah.
If you deal with crisis intervention, for example... Crisis intervention doesn't just happen in law enforcement. I mean, as psychologists, who knows better than we do about the world of crisis intervention, whether you're dealing with a distraught couple or trying to talk someone out of a suicide attempt. I mean, any of us who work in the real world of psychology should have adequate training in crisis intervention. And one of the points I make in the first chapter of the book is, in essence, a lot of what's in the book isn't startlingly new. It's really, again, applications of well-validated principles of psychology to the world of law enforcement police work. And I guess the unique contribution is doing it in a practical way. Because remember, these are cops. If they can't pick this up and use this right from the get-go, then they're not going to have any interest in it. They don't want, you know, then unlike us academic psychologists, they're less interested in the theory. They want to know, what can I do right now? How does this apply? And a lot of the content of the book grew out of my experiences teaching in police academies and seminars and lectures. And basically, the two words I heard most often were, so what?
Yeah.
You know, what how's that going to help me in a practical situation when I'm involved in an armed suspect, or if I'm trying to talk down a suicide, or if I've got a hostage crisis or a domestic violence situation? You know, what do I actually do?
Right.
And that was really the challenge, was to take these concepts and kind of boil them down to usable principles.
Definitely. You know, I myself, when I was a newly minted PhD, was asked to teach a course in Introduction to Psychology for the Police Department of Santa Rosa, California. I sure wish I had had this text then, I can tell you, because I just kind of covered straight intro to psych, and they were reasonably interested, I have to say, even though it was a pretty straight intro to psych type class, and it didn't have all the very focused practical advice that your book has. And indeed, your book is theoretically solid to a very impressive degree, with lots of academic citations, many of which I was impressed to see are research papers that you authored. But at the same time, it's very readable. I like the way you seamlessly move back and forth between academic language and cop talk.
Well, again, you know, a lot of my lessons on how to teach and how to write came from all the bad experiences I've had as a student and a graduate student and basically learning how not to do things.
Mm-hmm.
And on the one hand, you know, I become frustrated with books which are academically sound, but at the same time, you know, read like you're reading from the telephone book. I mean, it's just dry and boring, and basically they're a strain to read, even if you like this stuff.
I know exactly what you're talking. Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. And that
at the same time, you have books that are written from a practical point of view, but unfortunately, the theory behind it is basically you know, BS. I mean, it really has no factual foundation. So what I wanted to do, and hopefully have succeeded in doing, is creating a book that an academic scholar can look at and considered to be a valid presentation of the field of police psychology, but that any cop can kind of pick up and use. And, you know, hopefully this book will achieve that goal.
Yeah, well, as I say, I think it really does. I know we have at Sonoma State University, where I've taught for years, we have a criminal justice department. I'll call it to their attention. I think it ought to be a standard text across the land.
That's usually where most police psychology, per se, or police science or behavioral or law enforcement science is taught at departments of criminal justice.
Mm-hmm.
Psychologists, for some reason, are sort of late to come to this field of study, even though you'd think it would be directly applicable to their work. Just this coming fall, I'll be teaching a course in police psychology at Florida Atlantic University, and I was invited to do so by the department chair because basically I sent him a copy of the book, and he said, wait a minute, why don't you teach a course in this? And I was actually surprised that their own criminal justice department didn't have a course in police psychology, but apparently they didn't. And so, we're sort of jumping in to fill the gap.
Yeah, yeah. You know, in our psychology department, there was an interesting phenomenon of lots of sweet young things, young women, co-eds, who were declaring an interest in becoming criminal profilers, you know, like for the FBI or the CIA
right.
or something like that. I get probably due to the influence of some television shows or something. I'm not sure.
Well, you know, it's interesting you mentioned criminal profiling because if you look at the data and in the number of actual cases where criminal profiling is either an exclusive or a major contributor to solving a case. Do you know what the percentages are?
I don't.
About 3 to 8%.
Really low.
So it's not like criminal profiling is useless, but I think it's been overblown, again, due to the influence of television and Hollywood. It still is a fascinating area of forensic science, and I would not discourage anybody from going into it. But like anything that we know about, whether it's in criminal justice or psychology, and whether it's a school of psychotherapy or a particular psychometric test, what people tend to do is imbue whatever they're working with as the end-all and be-all, and what happens is it does have some limited applicability, but by overblowing it, you essentially undermine the credibility of the areas where it would have worked in the first place.
Yeah. Well, it's maybe a good thing that I didn't know that because I co-authored a book in which I was invited to and did try my hand at profiling a famous unsolved serial murder case. The book's called This is the Zodiac Speaking. And you might take a look at that at some time and you can send me back my grade.
What was your experience in working in that area?
Well, I was working with very fragmentary evidence. I was working with letters that the Zodiac killer had sent to the police department and the newspapers, basically threatening and taunting letters. And so based on very fragmentary evidence, you know, I drew some conclusions. And I went out way out on a psychological limb where I expected I might get nailed by my colleagues. So far it hasn't happened, but we'll see. But let's get back to your book. I find your chapter titles fascinating, and let me take you through some of them, and perhaps you can give us kind of a top-line overview. For example,
sure.
For example, you talk about Street Psychology 101. What do you see as the basics of Street Psychology 101?
Well, you basically have officers, you have beat cops or patrol cops, whose job is to interact with citizens on a day-to-day basis. And believe it or not, most police officers want their job to be easier rather than harder. And much of the interaction that police officers have with citizens are usually in the context of some kind of problem. And so the thrust of that chapter is basically helping cops be able to use communication strategies to defuse situations that might otherwise escalate into dangerous or violent situations. And this is anything from mediating neighbor disputes to mediating disputes between two merchants to intervening in domestic calls to also dealing with mentally ill citizens.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you know, applying some of the lessons of basic crisis intervention and just plain good communication skill can enable a lot of officers to basically keep situations from blowing over. Now, a lot of good cops already do this. And in fact, when I teach in my courses, there are always a couple of cops who sort of look at me and shrug and say, well, you know, this is what I've been doing all along. And the answer is yes, and that's why you probably have, you know, a good relationship with the community that you patrol. And that's very important in this era of what's called community policing. Because for a long time in the 60s and 70s, police departments or police officers were often seen as armies of occupation patrolling through the neighborhood, much like an occupying military force. And in the late 70s through the 80s and certainly in the last decade, the move in major cities has been to essentially establish what used to be what our parents and grandparents understood, which was the beat cop, the cop who intimately knew his neighborhood, knew the people, was familiar with them, because that actually prevents crimes from happening before they start, because you have a much more familiar and cooperative citizen population. And to do that, you do need to have good communication skills. I mean, the era of, you know, patrolling around in a squad car, jumping out and making an arrest, are pretty much over if you want to have effective policing in the modern world.
What about
that chapter is a way of helping to do that?
Yeah, what about cops on mountain bikes? That's a trend I've noticed. Where do you see that? Is that sort of midway between the patrol car and the cop walking around?
Well, you know, cops have to respond to their terrain. I mean, if the area that has to be covered is just too big to be covered on foot, then obviously you have to use some kind of vehicle. And if you think about it, a bike is a lot less insulating than a police car.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a bike essentially is, you're on the street, even though you're rolling down the street instead of walking. So it really is more of an intimate connection with the citizenry than being in a car. I think probably the reason they went to mountain bikes was purely practical. I mean, a bike can take you places faster, and if you do have to go places or even pursue a suspect, you can do so far more efficiently on a bike in many areas than you can do in a police car.
Mm-hmm.
A bike is still faster than a person can run, but you know, you can't get a police car down an alley or over grass the same way you can a mountain bike. So in every sense of the word, probably the areas where this has been employed, it's been quite successful.
Yeah, it certainly makes sense to me, and plus I'm
I don't know that I like wearing those little short pants.
Yeah, right, exactly. They do look vulnerable in those little shorts. Yeah, you were talking about the mediation, and I don't know if you've got your book in front of you and if you'll remember the specific steps. I know sometimes things I've written, I don't necessarily remember everything I wrote. But I wonder if you're able to take us through some of the specific steps that you outlined for a police officer to be a mediator in a domestic or neighborhood dispute. You've kind of broken it down into specific steps.
Well, I don't have the book in front of me, but I'll try to reconstruct it. And basically what you do is, again, very little in this book is absolutely brand new, you know, made up on the spot. A lot of this is employing well-validated principles of what's called arbitration and mediation that have been used in other contexts. I mean, business people have been using mediation and arbitration for decades. Countries, when they have political debates, you know, the Camp David Accords was a perfect example of mediation. And, you know, I use those two terms as others have used them. Mediation, basically having the officer serve as a go-between to clarify and focus the different positions of the disputing parties, again, whether they may be a husband and wife in a domestic dispute or two neighbors that are arguing about something in their yard, or two merchants who are having a conflict over something. And basically what the officer engages in is a kind of shuttle diplomacy. And then at the end sort of clarifies and allows the two disputants to arrive at their own conclusion, which the officer then sort of puts his unofficial stamp of approval on. And it's surprising how people who are fighting, when they have a kind of a neutral third party, if indeed you can convince both parties that the officer is being neutral, but assuming you can do that, it's very effective because the officer still has that stamp of authority.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times it enables people to arrive at conclusions through negotiation themselves that they wouldn't be able to do if they just had to do it face-to-face. When that doesn't work, a lot of times what you'll move to is something called arbitration, which is a similar process of going back and forth and clarifying and focusing everybody's position. But here, because the two parties really can't come to an agreement on their own, the officer says, look, I'm going to make the command decision. I'm going to listen to you. And much like a judge in a court case, I'm going to decide what I think is fair. And, you know, you agree to abide by this if you want me to do this. And again, it's surprising how many times people, if they believe the process to be fair, will go along with this kind of procedure. Now remember, what I've just described takes time. It takes time and it takes a certain degree of communication skill. Not every officer, in fact, not many officers, are going to be very comfortable and familiar doing this. The really good cops do this instinctively because this is just a gift that they have, and they've honed it and refined it through using it. But virtually any of these skills and virtually any of the skills in this book can be taught through sufficient training and practice. And if you do that, you're going to be a much more effective officer in the sense of having a community that has a low crime rate without having to have a high arrest index.
You know, one of the things that I liked about your book is that you have sample interactions and sort of sample dialogues that really sound like they've come right out of life. And they're easily transportable into other situations, and that's why I think this book potentially has practicality for people who are not involved in law enforcement. And I found one of the segments that I really like that illustrates what you've just now described in this sort of officer as mediator situation. And I'd like to read from your book a couple of paragraphs here that really illustrate what you're talking about. And it's kind of a script that an officer might use. So the officer says, let me see if there's anything preceding it. The officer says, "Okay, folks, I can see you're having difficulty working this out. So maybe I can help here. We're going to try something called mediation. I'm going to hear each of you out, get each of your sides of the story, and then I'll help you come to a decision. Hopefully, I'm not going to have to make the decision for you, because if you come to some agreement, I want it to be your agreement. But my role is to help clarify the situation and help each of you understand where the other one is coming from. Hopefully, you can work it out between you. Remember, this is voluntary, but if you agree to try to settle things this way, the decision will be binding, all right? If it seems clear that we're getting nowhere, or if you just don't want to do things this way, then I'll have to make a command decision so this doesn't blow out of control. But my first choice is that you guys work it out for yourselves. Okay, a couple of ground rules. The basic word here is respect. Otherwise, this isn't going to work. So no shouting, cursing, or threatening. You know, if anyone gets physical, that's an arrestable offense. So keep it peaceful, all right? I want to make sure everybody gets heard. So when one person is speaking, no interruptions from the other side. The next speaker gets the same courtesy. Also, this is between us. As long as I don't have to make an arrest or disclosure, disclose something reportable, this conversation stays with me. So I urge you to keep things confidential between yourselves so this doesn't become the latest gossip of the neighborhood. If you're having trouble dealing with this face-to-face, I may have to separate you and shuttle back and forth to help you hammer out an agreement. And if we're still getting nowhere, I'll have to play Judge Wapner and make the final decision myself. But hopefully, I can help you guys work it out for yourselves." So that was a great example of the kind of practical scenario setting that you do in the book.
I'm glad you brought that up, because that raises two important points. One of the things I do in my courses and training seminars is I give the cops of the course or the seminar attendees a copy of a very similar script.
Mm-hmm.
And I ask them to first go through it pretty much as it's written. And even though I try to do it colloquially, it's still, when you write something on a page, it does sound a little bit stiff and wooden.
Mm-hmm.
So what I ask the cops in the class to do is then make up their own version, you know, talk in their own idiom. So somebody who is in, patrolling an area that's sort of a white middle class area is going to talk a little differently than someone who's patrolling in the hood.
Yes.
And I ask them to speak in a language that's most comfortable to them and most comfortable to their constituents, and do it in a couple of different ways, and then do it in the opposite way. So in other words, the hood guy talks in the middle class idiom and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
And by doing this, even though, it sounds artificial and there's a lot of joking and laughing in the class, eventually what the officers do is they get very comfortable talking to different kinds of people in different styles. And so when they come across a real situation, again, it doesn't feel like suddenly they have to pull out their script like they're doing, a cold call selling. It actually feels something natural that's coming from them, which, if you think about it, is the basic for any training. I mean, and I use that analogy. If they're on the firearms range and they're shooting at a target, the goal is not to be able to shoot in a modified Weaver stance at a target 200 yards away. The goal is to be able to, quote-unquote, shoot from the hip and be able to deal with things as they come. So the same kind of practice and overlearning and practicing in different contexts applies to verbal skills the same way it does to physical skills. And, of course, the second point, what I mentioned earlier, to do this takes time. It takes time, and the more comfortable you are with the process, the more likely you are to spend the time that's necessary. But in terms of neighborhood and community policing, it definitely pays off.
Yes, I can really imagine. It's a stretch for me, actually, to imagine a policeman carrying out that sort of mediation that I just read. And I believe it when you say that it is possible. I just have never encountered a policeman who is working at that level.
Well, again, have you been in a situation where you've been on the street arguing with someone and a cop car pulls up and says, "Okay, what's going on here?" Typically, somebody like you and I, because of our own demographic, is mm-hmm. going to experience a police officer in a negative way most commonly for some kind of traffic stop. And even then, I mean, if you think about it, if you've been pulled over more than once, anybody who's had that experience several times knows that there's tremendous difference in terms of how the officer behaves. Anything from, nasty and sarcastic and cynical to kind of friendly and, you know, have a nice day.
Right.
To everything in between.
Yeah.
And again, there's a way of interacting with people. You know, it's interesting. We talk about television, but sometimes there are positive aspects. If you watch that TV show Cops.
Right, I've seen it.
And you see how some of these officers do act towards some of the people they talk to. If nothing else about that show, it is good at portraying the different styles that officers have in these kinds of critical situations. And you can almost see, if you watch enough of these shows, you can almost predict, you know, within 10 seconds, this is going to be a takedown situation. Where in other situations, you see if somebody who knows good communication skills basically taking a situation that might have exploded and calming it down.
Yeah, so I've been.
I guess it's one positive use of reality television.
Right, and some people, as you point out, are naturally gifted in this way. I've been in situations where my back immediately got up because of something that somebody said that was kind of provocative. But I was with somebody who was very good at diffusing a situation and just said something humorous or made themselves just very kind of plain and non-threatening, and it kind of diffused the situation. So I know from my own experience what you're getting at here.
Well, remember, if you think of a police officer as somebody who has to be a professional, police officers are the only non-military profession that is not only permitted but mandated to use coercive physical force as part of their job. If you think about it, and I tell this to citizen groups all the time, and some cops don't even realize it. If you fall down in the street and clutch your chest in pain, and a paramedic ambulance just happens to be in the neighborhood, and they zoom up to you, and they leap out with all their equipment, and you say, "Don't touch me," guess what? They're not allowed to touch you. If you're conscious enough and stable enough and competent enough to say, "Don't touch me, I do not want to be treated," they cannot treat you. On the other hand, let's say you get up, you recover, and you're walking home, and you see a little disturbance going on, and you start becoming part of a crowd that starts gawking at the disturbance, and a police officer says, "Please move along," and you say, "Nothing doing, I want to watch this goings on," and he says, "Sir, if you don't move along, I'm going to have to arrest you, this is the restricted area," and you say, "I don't want to move along," he's going to arrest you. He will use coercive physical force to physically move you out of the area. If anyone else did that to you, they could be subject to arrest themselves. And with this comes tremendous responsibility.
Right.
And what I tell officers is when you put on that uniform or, you know, plain clothes or whatever it is, part of your professionalism is how you react. And the best police officers, the best soldiers, the best salespeople, the best people who are in any kind of situation where you deal with the sometimes obstreperous aspects of human nature, if you take things personally, you're not going to last very long in this business.
Mm-hmm.
Because
right.
You will be very easy to control.
Right.
And so when you have a citizen who's cursing at you, yelling at you, calling all kinds of names, part of the job, part of what you're getting paid to do is have a certain demeanor and a certain behavioral style that is not going to further inflame the situation. Now, of course, we all know it's easier said than done, but it certainly is an aspirational model that anybody in a position of great physical responsibility should try to abide by.
Right. A frequent kind of police call involves domestic disputes, and you say that cops dread those calls. Why is that?
Well, the two most dangerous calls in police work are traffic stops and domestic calls. Traffic stops because of the sheer unknowability of it, and the sheer unpredictability. Remember, you literally have no idea who is in that car.
Mm-hmm.
It could be just some poor little old lady who lost her way.
Right.
It could be some guy who's got a car full of drugs, and this is his strike three, and he knows if he goes down this time, he's going away forever, and no way he's ever going back to jail, so he'll do anything to get out of there. So in the sheer unpredictability of it, traffic stops are dangerous. What makes domestic calls dangerous is the sheer level of emotion involved. When you have two people who do have personal relationships with each other, either it has not escalated to physical violence yet, and the neighbors have called the police because they're shouting and screaming and babies crying and so on, or there has been physical injury, in which case a mandatory arrest is usually called for. But because the people are in such a high state of emotion, it can turn violent at any moment. If two people are arguing and you get in the middle of them, what's going to happen? At the same time, officers who go into a home or a domicile are in an unknown area with unknown rooms. You don't know who else is in the house. You have a dangerous situation because even if a fight breaks out and the officer has to use physical force to arrest a suspect, or even if he has to defend himself against a gun-wielding suspect, you don't know if there are kids in the house. You don't know who else is there. So here you have the combination of an unknown situation with high, volatile emotions going on. And it's very easy for these things to escalate out of control. And that's why it is a tribute to an officer's communication skill when they can defuse this kind of situation and not have to make an arrest if no violence has taken place.
Okay, let me ask you about one more chapter in your book, which has tips for hostage negotiations. And we've all seen these dramatically depicted in movies and TV shows. How accurate are those depictions?
Interestingly enough, the ones that I've seen, I mean, I'm not an avid, I don't watch every single Hollywood depiction, but the few that I've seen have actually been pretty accurate.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the process. Remember, what they're showing you on TV is probably a few seconds or minutes of a process that typically lasts hours or days.
Right.
I mean, the sheer exhaustion factor of a hostage negotiation is probably the most draining aspect of it. Because they're not usually resolved within, the half-hour TV show.
Yes.
And you can have hours and hours where literally nothing goes on, and then you can have 15 seconds of punctuated conversation. So it can be extremely nerve-wracking and extremely frustrating. What's phenomenal is that, as a whole, negotiated hostage situations have a 95% success rate. That is, it's resolved without any violence taking place. And it's hard to imagine most medical procedures in critical situations that have a 95% success rate. So it's a tribute to the power of human communication to defuse situations. Hostage situations are unique because they combine elements of danger with the presence of a usually disturbed or distraught hostage taker, and you have the presence of innocent people whose lives are at stake at every second. But again, the same generalizable skills of crisis intervention that you would use for a suicide intervention or any other kind of violent subject or a barricade situation where someone doesn't want to come out but there may not be actual hostages, the same types of verbal approaches are effective in these situations. You're just applying it to one particular area.
Okay. Well, let's pull back a little bit and look a bit at your own background. When did you first know that you wanted to become a psychologist? What was it about the profession that called to you?
Actually, I started out by wanting to be a writer.
I did too.
I wanted to be a novelist.
Interesting. Me too.
Because I always enjoyed reading, and I always lived in kind of a world of books. I actually started out as an English major, and I think it was my first or second course as an English major in college, where luckily enough or unluckily enough, I had a professor who was a particular stickler for detail.
Yeah.
And this is the kind of guy who, you know, the professor from hell that everybody dreads having. The only thing that was missing was the tweed jacket and the pipe.
Okay.
And he was more concerned with, you know, how wide the margins were and how many words were on the page and rules and regulations, and really cared nothing for the creative process, which to me seemed bizarre for an English major. And at the same time, I had met someone who was a little older than me and had just graduated with his bachelor's degree in psychology, and this looked like something interesting. And besides, it was there was more literature in psychology and psychology in literature than there was in other fields. And so I kind of got hooked and liked the aspect of learning things about human nature, but instead of writing about them in novels, being able to look forward to the prospect of applying them in real life.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of what kind of launched my undergraduate career.
And where was that?
That was at Queens College, the City University of New York college system.
I thought I was hearing a little New York in your voice there, even though you're living in Florida now.
Well, I'm glad you're hearing a little, because when I speak to people from New York who I haven't spoken to for the 18 years I've been in Florida, they can't believe that I'm actually pronouncing my consonants.
Okay.
Yeah, when I speak to people from who are Florida natives or from different parts of the country, they ask me if I just got off the bus from the Bronx.
Yeah, right. So where did you go after Queens College?
Well, I got my master's degree at Queens College as well, and then went to the City University of New York, still called City College.
Mm-hmm.
They had, in the interim, I became very interested in the brain, took some neuropsychology classes, physiological psychology classes, and became fascinated by the human brain. and wanted to study the area of brain behavior relationships. And so I went to first a program that dealt specifically with physiological psychology, mainly experimental, which was doing research with mainly animals.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a different branch of the City University system that was a human neuropsychology program that actually dealt with human beings who had different kinds of brain injuries or dementias or learning disabilities, and basically did my graduate work there, and actually did my practicum at a psychiatric facility. So after doing rotations through VA hospitals and places like that, evaluating and dealing with stroke victims and brain injury victims, I actually started getting interested in the neuropsychology of, I guess you'd call, psychiatric syndromes, like schizophrenia, depression, substance abuse, and so on, and basically worked for several years at a psychiatric hospital doing neuropsychological evaluations of these patients, and actually did some research and published some papers on the neuropsychology of substance abuse and other syndromes.
Boy, you really have
I got my PhD, finally completed my doctorate, which I did on the neuropsychology of psychopaths, which were, today we call them antisocial personalities.
Yeah, very interesting.
I came to Florida because it was actually an interesting job opportunity at a sister hospital of the hospital I had worked at in New Jersey. And I was down here and basically stayed with that institution for about a year and then basically went into private practice. And in the meantime, got interested in the forensic aspects of neuropsychology, everything from, in the beginning, mostly civil forensics, which dealt with things like personal injury and compensation claims, where I would evaluate people and document the level and extent of their brain injury and brain impairment and relate this to damages for civil cases, in addition to seeing regular patients as any clinical psychologist and psychotherapist would. And through my work in neuropsychology, I got involved in evaluating and treating other kinds of patients with different types of what I call traumatic disability syndrome, such as chronic pain and post-traumatic stress disorder. And what I started to discover is many of the symptoms of individuals with a post-concussion syndrome, for example, overlapped with those of individuals who had been psychologically traumatized, problems with attention and concentration, mood disturbances, and so on. So I became interested in the process of psychological traumatization, which led me to treat a sort of wider variety of injury victims, including a few firefighters, emergency service workers, and police officers who would come in with varying types of syndromes. And then I became involved in the critical incident stress movement, the wonderful organization, the International Critical Incident Stress Foundation, that was started by Jeffrey Mitchell. And still active today, and became the clinical director of the Palm Beach County Critical Incident Stress Debriefing Team. I know that's a mouthful. And basically what we would do is go out and on critical calls where personnel from police officers to firefighters to paramedics, if they had a particularly difficult and traumatic call, usually involving the death of a child or maybe serious injury of a colleague, they would need a kind of very quick traumatic stress debriefing to sort of get them going and either provide the basis for a further follow-up or just kind of patch it together so they continue with their work. And after several years of doing this, I literally got a call in the middle of the night one night from one of the police officers I had worked with and said, we have an officer-involved shooting. We need you to come to the scene. And my response to him was, you know, don't you have a guy who does this for your department? And his response was basically, you're it. So that was my field promotion as the police psychologist of the West Palm Beach Police Department. And then it, you know, became more involved in some other aspects of police work, including a lot of the stuff that's covered in the book. And so things have sort of come full circle. I mean, I still do some of the neuropsychology. I do have a private practice where I see clinical patients, and a lot of it is also forensic psychology and police psychology. And in addition to that, I became interested in victim services. So I do work a lot with crime victims, and I do a fair amount of criminal psychology, forensic criminal psychology evaluations to the courts, things like dangerousness, capacity to stand trial, insanity defense, and so on. So I keep myself pretty busy.
Boy, it sure sounds like it. You have a very diverse and deep background. What if there's a listener who wants to follow a similar career path? I do have some students that listen to this show. Is there a program somewhere in the country that you would recommend for graduate study?
Because people are, that's a great question. People are always asked, they want to, again, largely due to, I guess, the influence of television, you know, how does one become a police psychologist or a forensic psychologist or, you know, a guy like the ones they see on CSI or SVU.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a couple, actually several routes you can take. You can take the criminal justice law enforcement route, or you can take the psychology route. And, you know, and I tell that to people because I don't want them to think there's only one way to do it. And a lot of it involves that the university or the educational system that's convenient to the person. So if you live in an area where, or if you, or if you're in a college that has a fantastic criminal justice department but doesn't have much of a psych department, then you can major in criminal justice and take your minor as psych, and then when you go on to graduate school, you can either get a degree in criminal justice or psych with a focus in forensics. On the other hand, if you're already a psych major or even a practicing psychologist and you want to get some training, then you can take some training in criminal justice and police psychology and do it that way. What a lot of young people who are starting out do in an ideal sense is do kind of a double major where they'll do psych and criminal justice. And that way when they graduate, they're prepared to go into whatever department will most support their career goals.
Okay, well, you know what? We've run out of time here. I could just go on and on with this interview because you do have so many areas of specialization. I'm really so happy to have discovered you and your book. And Dr. Larry Miller, thanks so much for being our guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, it's been my pleasure, and this interview has been a delight.
I hope you enjoyed today's interview with police psychologist Dr. Larry Miller. For my post-interview commentary, I'll just briefly touch on my own three brief encounters with forensic psychology. I think you heard me mention in the interview that I once taught an introduction to psychology course for the Santa Rosa, California Police Department. One of the funny things I remember from that class is that there was one officer in the class who periodically would flash me a smile beneath his thin cop-style mustache. Because he would systematically flash me this smile, I found myself feeling very good about my lecturing ability, and I probably began directing more and more of my comments in his direction. Maybe you've heard about the studies showing that students can selectively give a teacher positive reinforcement by smiling and looking very attentive, and gradually condition the teacher in that way to stand in one corner of the room. The teacher ends up standing in the corner because he has unconsciously learned that he evidently is much more effective when in that particular location. So I've got this cop smiling away at me, and I'm just feeling better and better about myself. Some sessions later, however, I began to realize that this guy wasn't smiling at me in approval at all. He just had a nervous tic. In fact, he was baring his teeth in a kind of hostile grimace. Whenever I think back on that incident, I have a good laugh on myself. One of my other brushes with forensic psychology was my co-authoring of a book on a famous serial killer who was never caught. You heard me mention the book in the interview. If I do say so myself, it's well written, if you've got the stomach for the violent crimes that are described there. It's called This is the Zodiac Speaking, Into the Mind of a Serial Killer, and you can get it on Amazon.com. Part of the fascination of this case is that the Zodiac wrote a number of coded messages in which he claimed one could discover his identity. I just recently received a series of emails from a reader in Ireland who claims to have broken a key part of the code that actually gives the Zodiac's true identity. And periodically I hear from other readers who say that in reading the book, they realize the Zodiac is someone they know. They usually say they're afraid to go to the police because this person they suspect to be the Zodiac will realize that it was them and take revenge. HBO actually purchased an option on the book, planning to make a 12-part serial, but backed out when they learned another production company was making a major Hollywood film about the Zodiac case. So there goes another of Dr. Dave's brushes with worldwide fame. My third brush with forensic psychology was my effort to get into the mock jury business. In large cases, lawyers will sometimes hire a specialist to bring together a group of ordinary citizens who share the characteristics of an actual jury. Then either the specialist or the lawyer can present his major arguments before this, quote, mock jury to see which arguments and strategies are likely to play well in the actual trial. The specialists who conduct these mock juries or mock trials tend to be very well compensated. I figured that with my background in psychology and market research, this sort of work would be right up my alley. I paid a rather large sum of money to a woman who was offering training to enter the field. I hesitated to spend so much money for this training, but the thing that finally tipped the balance for me was that she offered me a money-back guarantee. So, to make a long story short, I took the training, tried to sell my services to local attorneys with absolutely no luck. When I tried to invoke my money-back guarantee, the woman wouldn't answer any of my communications. Turns out she had bilked a number of other people as well. And because she's located in another part of the country, I haven't been able to get any satisfaction legally. Turns out a money-back guarantee is only as good as your ability to collect. Well, you might be able to imagine the vengeful sorts of fantasies I entertained for a while, but ultimately I decided it was better for my own mental health to write off the loss and move ahead. Hey, are there any lawyers listening who could use a mock jury? I'll do a great job, honest. I'll even give you a money-back guarantee.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
As you may know, we've been taking part in a promotion for the domain name and web hosting company GoDaddy. Well, I just saved myself some money using the very discount codes I've been providing you. For my market research business, I already own the domain e-focusgroups.com, and I've spent a lot of time building equity in my eFocus Groups brand. So I just now used GoDaddy, however, to foreclose competitive squatting by purchasing eFocusGroups.biz, eFocusGroups.info, eFocusGroups.org, .us, and .net. And I saved money in the process. So if you're thinking of buying a domain name, transferring a domain, or getting some web hosting, just go to our site at shrinkwrapradio.com and look in the left-hand margin and you'll find a link to three different promotional codes that will entitle you to some great discounts. And while you're looking at the left-hand side of the show's page, you'll also find a link to our Frapper page, and if you haven't already done so, please put yourself on our Frapper map, which allows you to place a digital push pin on the location where you live. You can get there from our site at shrinkwrapradio.com or by going directly to www.frapper.com/shrinkwrapradio, and Frapper is spelled F-R-A-P-P-R. Just to update you, we now have 116 pins on the map, which is great. However, that only represents about 5% of our total listenership. Where the heck are the rest of you located? I'd really like to know. Take a moment and go to our homepage, find the Frapper link, and let us see where you are. I get such a thrill each time I discover a new pin on the map. So here's a shout out to a few of the recent additions. Magpie in Geneva, Illinois, thanks so much for signing up. Katie in Chicago, Illinois. Michael in Vienna, Austria. John in Wellington, New Zealand. Jody, my eFocus Group's client in Delray Beach, Florida. Nate in Chicago. Jake in Bristol, England. Paul Moore in County Carlow, Ireland. My chauffeur and assistant in the Irish workshop finally signed up on Frapper. Thank you, Paul. And finally, Dennis in Chicago, Illinois. Now, once again, let me remind you of my upcoming workshop in Tuscany, Italy. This will be a week-long personal growth workshop that I'll be co-leading with Dr. Ron Alexander, and it will be in a beautiful Tuscan retreat center. So for those of you who are already in Europe, it's an easy trip for you, and September is a great time of year to be there. The dates are September 18 to 24, and we've got room for a total of 8 to 15 people, and there's still room for you. You can find a link to the retreat center on my About Dr. Dave page at shrinkwrapradio.com. Hey, drop me an email right away if you're interested and would like more information. This is your chance to get an intensive experience of me, Dr. Dave, and Dr. Ron Alexander, who is my guest on show number 29. If you enjoy Shrink Wrap Radio, then this is an experience you really owe yourself.
Hi, this is Melissa Van Nuys, and you're on the couch with my father-in-law, Dr. Dave.
This is the place where I would normally read from our email. Unfortunately, this is the first time in our 40 shows that Shrink Wrap Radio has not received a single listener email. Hey, what's up with that? To me, the email you send is important not only because of the encouragement I take from it, but also because I think reading it here on the show helps to build a sense of community. You get to hear yourself and you get to hear from other like-minded souls out there who share your interest in the bigger psychic picture. That's also why I read out the names of the people who've just signed up on our Frapper map to build that sense of community among us. So let's get that email faucet flowing again. You can send your listener email and feedback to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. My username on Skype is shrinkpod. And speaking of unused resources, nobody has used the My Chingo recording facility on our site yet. My friend Jerry Trumbull helped me test it out, and the sound quality is great. All you need is a microphone hooked up to your computer. There's no cost to you or to me. And again, sharing your voice is a great way to build this community. You'll see a bright green My Chingo logo on the left side of each of the Shrink Wrap Radio pages. Just click on that and the rest will become self-evident. It's very simple to use. You can record a comment or a question, or you can record one of those little transitions I like to use along the lines of, "Hi, this is Maria from Quito, Ecuador, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave." By the way, in a couple of days, I take off for 5 days of shamanic training with the Four Winds Society in Park City, Utah. If you've listened to show number 31 on shamanic psychology with Dr. Alberto Violdo, you'll have some idea of what I'm up to. I plan to take my digital recorder with me, and maybe I'll capture some good material to share with you. In the meantime, my next show may be a little late due to this trip, but do stay subscribed. I think you'll especially like the next show, which will be on body-mind healing using Qigong and Tai Chi. Please help spread the word about Shrink Wrap Radio to your friends and colleagues. If you have a podcast or a blog, I'd sure appreciate a plug there. I want to close by once again thanking Dr. Larry Miller for sharing his insights into practical police psychology. And in keeping with that theme of law and order, our closing PodSafe music reminds us that we might not want to take a free ride in a cop car, which is the title of the song by the Clintons. You can find out more about the Clintons, and you can purchase the song on the PodSafe Music Network by going to the link on our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
The perfect getaway, And it's a proverbial payday in a loser's sort of way. Take the keys, take the back roads, and our hair, it's looking good for a couple of criminals. But it never goes as planned. You get run down by the man, and instead of beating till the whole heart of the games and pulling off the perfect scam, you know we're looking at a free ride in a cop car. The view's not what I expected. Free ride in a cop car, yeah. Then again, the view's not so there's a big man in a blue uniform, and he's staring down on me. How'd you find us? Where did we go wrong? And I see we left the truck out front as he's throwing the bracelets on. Well, it never goes as planned. You get run down by the man, and instead of beating you, the whole horn of the games and sipping on a black and tan, you know we're looking at a free ride. The view's not what I expected. Free ride in a cop car, yeah. Then again, the view's not so bad.